Almost 1.5 million people in South Florida have been vaccinated. Back to school plans for next year and the future of gambling here. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. On WLRN, I'm Tom Hudson. More people are getting vaccinated, even as the use of one vaccine is paused. What's the impact of not using the Johnson & Johnson vaccine for the time being? One of the busiest vaccine sites in South Florida changed its rules this week, hoping to get more doses to more people. Meantime, public school districts are making plans for next fall. Students are expected to be back in their classrooms inside school buildings. So what's necessary for schools, teachers, parents, and kids to be ready? And Florida lawmakers are poised to make some changes to gambling laws. How could they affect where and how you place a bet in South Florida? It's all ahead on our program made possible by Willie the Bee-Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week and for supporting public media. Almost 1.5 million people in South Florida are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. Another 900,000 have had their first of two doses of vaccine. Anyone 18 years old and older can get a shot now, and that's been the case throughout the state for just about 2 weeks. The pace of vaccinations, though, slowed considerably earlier this week when the one-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine was pulled from being used for the time being. This is Governor Ron DeSantis on Tuesday after the Centers for Disease Control and the Food and Drug Administration recommended stopping the use of that Johnson & Johnson vaccine for now.
We're following the recommendation to pause. In the meantime, we're going to look closely at what they end up saying and doing. But my hope would be that this is something that is a little bit of a speed bump.
Well, that speed bump has meant a lot fewer people were vaccinated in South Florida the day after the pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine than the day before. So what's the concern of the J&J vaccine? What's the supply of the other vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, in South Florida? How go the efforts to expand vaccine availability across South Florida into the entire community? Have you been vaccinated? What's changed for you now that you're vaccinated? Share with us as we talk about the week in vaccinations in South Florida, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, live on this Friday afternoon. We're also on Twitter. Hit us up at WLRN. Veronica Zaragovia is the WLRN healthcare reporter, and she's back with us here on the South Florida Roundup. Veronica, what prompted the health officials from the FDA and the CDC to call for a pause? They caused a pause in distributing the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
Right. Well, first, I want to remind listeners that about 7 million people across the U.S. have received the one-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine against COVID-19. And earlier this week, U.S. health authorities urged for this pause out of extra caution because they want to investigate reports of 6 women out of those 7 million plus people between the ages of 18 and 48 who got that vaccine and developed serious but extremely rare blood clots and low levels of platelets, and one person even died.
What happens during this pause for federal regulators?
Well, what they want to know is, have other people experienced the kinds of symptoms that these women had reported? They have now announced today, the CDC, that the vaccine meeting will take place again next week on Friday the 24th. So they're going to take another week to investigate. And they say that actually they hope that this would only contribute to confidence because they're taking this seriously and they want to make sure they can also understand what is the right treatment and who's at risk.
The Johnson & Johnson vaccine, one dose versus the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, two doses. Pfizer and Moderna are RNA-based vaccines. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine is somewhat different, right, Veronica?
Right. So what it does is they genetically modified an adenovirus, which is a common cold that in the case of Johnson & Johnson that humans can have, and they put in a little bit of the genetic code of the spike protein that's important to the coronavirus that we're dealing with right now, the one that causes COVID-19.
Right.
And it seems that the concern, the other vaccines, the mRNA vaccines, the Moderna and Pfizer that you mentioned, have no reported symptoms of these, what's called cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, which is the type of blood clot that the six women have reported. And I did want to say that people, if you develop a severe headache or abdominal pain or shortness of breath, those are just going back to your previous questions, those within about 3 weeks of getting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, that you should see a medical provider. But there have been no similar types of symptoms with the other vaccines.
Dr. Rashid Chotani is with us as well, Veronica, Chief Medical Director of Ashbrit IEM. Ashbrit has been contracted by the state to run vaccine sites, including the one that's been operating at Hard Rock Stadium. Dr. Chotani, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Thanks for your time today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on this show.
What do you make of the pause for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine?
So the pause is of tremendous concern to the population, but what I want to make sure that everybody understands is that how transparent the system is, how seriously FDA, the federal government, CDC, and the local state governments take anything that happens to a small number of individuals, one in a 1 million case, right, seriously, to make sure that we look at it and carefully investigate what's going on, identify that if there are certain populations that are going to be high risk if this vaccine was administered to them or should be continued to administer this vaccine. I think this is just a pause to evaluate everything, and CDC and FDA is seriously taking a look at it. And that, to be honest about it, that should be reassurance to the population of our nation that our healthcare authorities are taking everything very seriously so that our population does not have any adverse effects and is given the best possible vaccine that's available out there.
A half dozen of these cases, what triggered this pause, Dr. Chotani, as you mentioned, as Veronica mentioned, out of 7 million people who have received the vaccine, share with us lay people here that kind of ratio and the kind of precaution that has led to at the FDA.
So yes, you can see that it's a very small ratio. There are phase one, phase two, and phase three studies that occur before the vaccine is given emergency authorization use by FDA, Food and Drug Administration.
Right.
After phase three, for any vaccine, we always have what is called phase four studies or surveillance studies, where we are reporting any adverse effects that are caused by any vaccine. There's a system that CDC has implemented, and through that system, it was picked up that six individuals got this unusual reaction where clots were being formed in a very simple, I'm trying to explain it in a very simple way.
Yeah, sure.
Clots were being formed, and they were happening in women who are in childbearing age. Mm-hmm. Now, we have seen similar type of a reaction in women who are pregnant who have taken birth control pills in the past. So there is something that is going on that essentially is affecting the hormones, perhaps, in these individuals. Studies still are being conducted and verified. That is what is being looked at right now. What is it that is causing this problem? Is it something that is in the vaccine? Is it something that we would see normally in the general population if X number of people were observed? So all of that is going to come out in about a week. But the great thing, again, what I want our nation to understand and Floridians to understand is that the medical authorities are taking everything so seriously that even if it's a one in a million reaction, and unfortunately there's one casualty associated with it, you know, things will stop, get reevaluated. All the scientists are going to take a look at it very carefully. And if they feel comfortable, then this vaccine will be, allowed to be administered to the population.
And I want to ask you what that kind of exit could look like, Dr. Chotani. Stick with us. Dr. Chotani is Chief Medical Director of Ashbrit IEM. Ashbrit runs some state vaccine sites, including Hard Rock Stadium. Veronica Zaragovia is our healthcare reporter here at WLRN, and caller Adam is with us from Miami Beach. Go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, I just wanted to say how really confident and safe it makes me feel the work that's being done by our scientific experts on the vaccines. And in particular, when you look and you can see that only 6 people out of 7 million have had this side effect, and yet it's being studied and it's been picked up, and it just makes me feel really, really confident and safe in having the vaccines and any of the vaccines. I think if you look, if you gave 6 million people a spoon of peanut butter, that you'd have people dying of anaphylactic shock and different side effects from that and stuff. There are 330 million people in the United States, roughly. There's way more than 330 people in car accidents and things like that, thousands and thousands. This is a tiny number, and the fact that it's still being studied after it's been released just gives me great confidence, and I would urge everyone to go out and get the vaccine, any of the vaccines, as soon as they can.
Adam, thanks for that call.
And also, one other thing I'll mention, it's important also. I think that we should all work together to do this, and I think we should really get our public officials to work on it. And I think that when we have corrupt politicians like Governor DeSantis, who thinks it's more important for college kids to have big parties than for seniors to have vaccines, that we really need to work on that.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to there, as the governor has been pretty clear on his vaccine strategy from late last year. As debatable as it may be, that strategy, putting seniors first and having an age-based prioritization that the governor put in place early on and throughout the vaccine distribution strategy at state sites. Dr. Rashid Chotani, let me get back to, though, the Johnson & Johnson pause in terms of the distribution of that vaccine. What does the exit potentially look like? Could that vaccine come back into distribution, but with additional warnings or perhaps more guidelines about who is best positioned to receive that vaccine?
So there are multiple exits over here. One exit might be that, okay, you know, we've looked at it. This is something that potentially could have happened in any case, a placebo effect, et cetera, which probably is not going to be the case. That could be one exit, right? The other exit is that, okay, there are certain individuals, especially because what we've seen is that all the people that were affected by this were in childbearing age, were females, right? Males have not had this reaction. So the exit
strategy, I think there's one male.
There's one male. You're right. Correct. But you know, so we'll have to take a look at all of those elements and be able to then clearly understand why is this happening. Right now, the question is, why is this happening? Why was this not observed during the clinical trials? So I would urge everybody to be patient. Let the scientific authority, the people that are looking at it, and studying the data under the supervision of Dr. Fauci and the rest of the amazing medical team that we have, to take a little pause. We have enough Moderna and Pfizer vaccine right now, and we are administering that vaccine at as quickly as possible in Florida. And believe me, all our sites, you know, have not seen a decrease in the number of people coming to get vaccinated. We have seen an increase.
Dr. Chotani, I want to talk just about that. Veronica Zaragovia, healthcare reporter at WLRN. Let me bring you back as we're talking here, Veronica. I'm watching the tweet deck, and Jackson Health System just tweeted out that Jackson continues to have availability for appointments at its COVID-19 vaccination sites through the end of the week and has extended availability for Monday, April 19th. What does supply and demand look like across the board at the various different vaccination distribution points?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's starting to look like demand is starting to taper down a little bit. And because, for instance, the site that, what I want to do is explain all the places where people can go and, yeah, and they don't need an appointment, because, for instance, Hard Rock Stadium that Dr. Chotani is overseeing, they've now extended until 10 p.m. from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. with no appointments necessary. And then yesterday, the Florida Department of Health in Broward County announced that all of their sites no longer require appointments. That includes Treetops Park in Davie, Coral Square Mall, TY Park in Hollywood, Markham Park in Sunrise. So if you can visit our website at WLRN.org, we have a post on how to make a vaccine appointment. And you actually, we need to change the title because so many places you don't need an appointment anymore.
Yeah, how to show up for your vaccine, I think, is the new headline, right? Yeah.
Right,
So what is leading to that dropping of the appointment requirement, Veronica? I mean, it's got to be a mix of the supply and demand, yeah?
Absolutely, and that's very important. It's not just that demand has tapered off, but that a lot of people still can't take the time off to sit in their car for an hour at one of these rather bigger sites. And I think they're trying to make it easier. They're also aware, as the Miami Herald has reported, and that Black residents of Florida are not getting vaccinated still at the rates of other residents of the state. And possibly eliminating appointment requirements will make it easier. So that's, one of the reasons for that.
Yeah. Talking about the racial disparity in the data, 12% of those vaccinated in Broward County are Black, according to the state data that I looked at this morning on this Friday morning, 6.6% Black in Miami-Dade County, 5.6% Black in Palm Beach County. So Dr. Chotani, how are the efforts to expand availability, and particularly into the broad population?
So it's a very, very important and a great question. One of the strategies that the governor had implemented was to start these sites in equity sites in neighborhoods which were black and brown, to make sure that these small sites, for example, at Broward North that we run, in Hialeah, in Miramar, or Overtown specifically, which we started, that was the first center that we started, was serving those populations. Yes, there is a disparity in terms of people coming and getting the vaccine in the Black and brown communities, specifically in the African American community. And community outreach is critical. Having this access of just driving in or walking in, all our sites, the ones that I mentioned, are walk-in sites and drive-in sites. So people should just find some time, drive in, walk, get the vaccine, and feel very good about it. I mean, there were people who initially thought that this would be a difficult thing for them to do, but believe it or not, once they get in the line, once they get the vaccine, they are happy as they can be. Yeah. And I urge all the citizens, I plead to all the citizens, especially in the minority areas, the Black and brown communities, to make sure that they do get the vaccine. One of the main problems that we had in terms of the numbers, high numbers in the Black and brown communities, was because you have multiracial family, multi-generational families living in those households. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've got elderly, middle age, as well as young folks. So that is so important. And I cannot emphasize that more than I can, that it is critical that they come and get the vaccine. The vaccine is safe, Moderna and Pfizer. We've looked at it. We have tested it. A lot of people have received the vaccine since December, mid-December. And, you know, the data looks very, very, very good.
Veronica, the Federal Emergency Management site that was opened in Miami-Dade County and had two satellite sites each week moving around the county, those were supposed to address some of the racial disparity in vaccination rates. Have they?
No, it seems like they have not, given state data. One thing that I keep hearing from healthcare advocates is that you need to bring the vaccines even closer. Like, these sites they're first of all, many of the satellite sites only offer second doses. And in fact, now Miami-Dade College, because of the Johnson & Johnson pause, they had to switch over and they're offering second doses. Mm-hmm. And so advocates are urging a mobile model where you bring vaccines, and a healthcare professional would be good to now answer questions if they're concerned about vaccine concerns. They have a health provider to ask those questions. And so it needs to be more like voting, where it's just in your communities and you don't have to take a lot of time, because now it's a two-dose vaccine that we have access to. So that's not easy for a lot of working people.
Dr. Chotani, you in the company you work for run the state site at Hard Rock Stadium, big site that's been operating for a number of months now, as a testing facility and now as a testing and distribution for the vaccine. Some of the rules about who could show up for a vaccine changed this week. What was that change and why was it made?
Which rule in terms of age or
not the age rule? No, yeah. So in terms of second doses, the previous rule at Hard Rock had been those who could receive second doses at Hard Rock were those who received their first doses at Hard Rock. But I think you've loosened up that requirement now, haven't you?
Yes, sir. And anybody who needs a second dose can come to our facility. Anybody who needs the first dose can come to our facility. There are two distinct lines. And people who have received the first dose are already in the system. And if they're not in the system, we make sure that they are in the system and then they get the second dose. So that has made things easier. And that is what needs to be done and has been done. And I think moving forward, it's going to be easier for people. It all depends if you're giving Moderna or Pfizer. 18 years or above or 16 years or above. And in about a week, that might change and it might be 12 years and above. So FDA is taking a look at it at this point.
Doctor, sorry for the interruption, but to clarify there, Moderna is still 18 years old and older. Is that correct?
Yes.
And
yes,
the Pfizer is as young as 16 years old currently. There are clinical trials for people as young as 12 years old. Is that for both vaccines or just one?
Right now, both vaccines have submitted applications to the FDA. The clinical trials that were done by Pfizer actually looked at younger age groups. Okay. So we'll see. We'll have to wait for one more week to make sure that the health authorities, federal health authorities, look at the data carefully and make their recommendation. Yeah. But I feel very confident that we are going to have younger people also getting vaccination in the next few months, if not earlier.
And by younger, you mean younger than 18 or 16 years old?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Veronica, back to the expansion or stretching out the vaccine distribution to all populations. What are the outreach efforts that you've been aware of? Both official and maybe more word of mouth type of efforts to spread the word about where the vaccination distribution points are currently and where they may be coming to.
Yeah, that's interesting. There have been a couple recent press conferences in Miami-Dade County, for instance, with the mayor and either elected officials or pastors of Black churches at Zoo Miami or at the Miami-Dade College site. There is a lot of word of mouth still going on, the state has sent out people who go kind of like canvassing and letting residents know about their vaccination options. And certainly family members, a lot of times I've been at sites where I see a group of people and I approach them to ask about getting the vaccine and they'll tell me, you know, I decided to get it and I brought three of my nieces. That was one example I had recently. And so that is probably one of the most effective ways is just for people, someone in the family to get the vaccine and then encourage others to come too.
Yeah. We talked earlier about the Johnson & Johnson pause for its vaccine as the Food and Drug Administration investigates half a dozen cases of blood clots out of the 7 million doses given nationwide. Susan is listening to the South Florida Roundup online from Sarasota. Susan, you've got some questions Dixie and Coral Springs had the questions about go. Let me try Dixie in Coral Springs. Questions about side effects for Pfizer and Moderna. Dixie, apologies. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I love NPR. So my question is, and I'm also very grateful that this has been identified, but it begs the question, does this mean that Pfizer and Moderna's effects are also being tracked? And what is the tracking system? A simple explanation, because it seems very randomized that you would find out what's happening with a person. I wonder how these six people came to bear, and can we trust that this is being done for the other two vaccines?
And then what will be
the condition to bring the Johnson & Johnson back on the market?
Great questions, Dixie. Dr. Chitani, we're a little tight on time, but first, the process that exists with these emergency authorization use allowances to report side effects to the FDA and the CDC? What is that process?
An excellent question. Again, every single day, as soon as somebody has an adverse reaction, and people do get anaphylactic reaction who have had history of allergies, et cetera, and some who might not have histories of allergies. If there is an adverse reaction, immediately after that individual has been taken care of, there's a system that CDC has put together. A report has to be generated, has to be put into that system, as well as another paper report has to be filed with the state so that all of this is tracked. Now, every single individual who gets a vaccine, if that individual has had side effects, is reported. And that is the process for every single vaccine, whether it's Moderna, whether it's Pfizer, whether it's J&J. And that is how we track all of this.
And I think, Dr. Wright, I mean, if somebody gets a vaccine, has a side effect, they call their healthcare professional or pharmacy, wherever they received that vaccine, and then that healthcare professional then can report that side effect to the FDA. Is there self-reporting on the part of the vaccine recipient, him or herself?
So as far as our big sites are concerned, we actually do the reporting to the CDC ourselves.
Right.
The small sites might be doing something different, but as far as our sites, the state-run sites are concerned, it's part of our job, a requirement to report every single, even the most minor side effect that has been seen in any individual.
And Tom, can I jump in really quickly?
Please do.
Sorry.
Yes, Veronica.
Just to tell our listeners that the CDC is urging people to self-report as well with an application called V-Safe, like V as in Victor-Safe. And then you can also let them know if you're getting any kind of symptoms, then they can, that'll help.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I prefer to think of it as V like Veronica, like
right,
V like
exactly.
Veronica safe. V like Veronica safe. Yeah.
Veronica safe, absolutely. And the other thing that needs to be, it's so important that anybody who's received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and within 1 to 2 weeks, some people are saying 3 weeks, if they observe any type of anything that is headaches, stomach aches, you know, nausea, whatever they're experiencing, if they're experiencing anything, that needs to be reported through V-Safe to CDC. It is important. Yeah. But if 1 month has passed and they've not really had any type of adverse effects, then most of the healthcare professionals right now, public health professionals, feel that they are now, they're past the risk area and they're safe at this point.
Okay. Dr. Rashid Jatani, Chief Medical Director of Ashbrit IEM. Ashbrit is contracted by the state of Florida to run some state vaccine distribution sites, including Hard Rock Stadium. Veronica Zaragovia also has been our guest, WLRN healthcare reporter. To each of you, thanks for sharing your expertise with us and our audience.
Well,
thank you for having us.
Yeah.
We've got more to come here on the South Florida Roundup this week, talking about plans to bring all public school students back to the classroom next year. That's next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week.
Broward County Public Schools will open the 2021-2022 school year with 100% in-person traditional face-to-face instruction at all schools this coming fall.
And with that statement on Tuesday, Superintendent Robert Runcie made clear Broward County Public School students will be back at their desks in August when the next school year begins. Public school students in Palm Beach and Miami-Dade counties also will be headed back to their classrooms next year. Now, we want to hear from parents, students, teachers, and staff this hour. How ready are you to return to the school building in August, especially if you've been learning or teaching online? How are schools preparing for the return of all students in August? And what are the virtual options for students if they want to stay online next year? Call us now, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can hit us up on social media. We're on Twitter, at WLRN. We start in Miami-Dade County. Colleen Wright is the education reporter for our partner, the Miami Herald. We spoke on Thursday. Colleen, welcome back to the South Florida Roundup. So what's the plan for the next school year for Miami-Dade County Public Schools?
The plan for next year is basically Miami-Dade County Public Schools wants 100% of students back in schools. They want everyone in person. They reconvene their ad hoc task force of medical experts and public health experts a few days ago this week, and just to look over existing protocols. They didn't make any concrete changes, but they talked a lot about, for example, seating on buses, whether they can go back to two from one. They've done one per seat this whole time. They have also looked at like spectators at games, quarantine procedures, maybe even shortening them down to, instead of 14 days, maybe like 10 days with proof of a negative test. These are some things that have just been floating. Again, nothing really changed, so that conversation is going to be ongoing.
Regarding planning for the next school year in August of this year, when the next school year begins, is it stated flatly that Miami-Dade County Public Schools will be back in the classroom 100%, or is there some wiggle room here?
I guess maybe there's some wiggle room, but they've said it pretty clearly that their goal is 100%. I know that the superintendent did tweet saying the other option that families have is Miami-Dade Online Academy, which is kind of like Miami-Dade's version of online virtual school that's been around since 2009. It doesn't seem completely definitive, but it kind of seems inching toward that way of come back into school or you have this other option of online academy.
The virtual school that students have been using this year is this MSO, My School Online. Is that the same thing as Miami-Dade Online Academy?
It's not. So My School Online was designed to basically mirror an in-person experience. So in My School Online, you report to the school that your child's been going to pre-pandemic with all their same teachers, maybe with a few exceptions, considering some teachers are out, maybe on medical leave or, you know, what have you during the pandemic. But it's supposed to mirror just a regular experience. That seems to be going away next school year. And now you just have to go back in person. And Miami-Dade Online is kind of like its own school. You would have to pull your child out of their neighborhood school or wherever they're going and enroll them into Miami-Dade Online Academy.
What about any vaccine requirements for students or staff who are eligible to receive vaccines?
Dr. Eileen Marty, who's also been advising Miami-Dade County Public Schools, who've been advising Miami-Dade County, City of Miami, she pointed out that these vaccines are on emergency use authorization. And so you legally actually can't have them be required for any legal setting. But she did mention that Pfizer is actually having talks with the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, on getting full licensure. And there is when, you know, you could start requiring them of, I guess, of teachers, of students. Although the superintendent, Superintendent Alberto Carvalho, did say that he does not foresee any change on that front, you know, requiring COVID-19 vaccines, kind of like they require measles or chickenpox vaccines, diseases like that. It doesn't seem like it's going to become a requirement only because of the short time frame, either for staff or students. He said he did not foresee that happening. And that would have to come from the state as well. That would not be a local decision. It would have to come from the Florida Department of Health.
Speaking of state decisions, we heard later in the week, the Department of Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran essentially telling school districts that masks for students in classrooms next school year should be voluntary. That's would represent a significant difference compared to mandatory masks this year in classrooms, right?
Yes. The letter that came from Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran kind of was asking school districts. It didn't seem to like associate with any penalties or have any repercussions if you don't follow through. It kind of has some claims about wearing masks. There is no data associated with these claims. He does make the claim that schools have been the safest places in the community. That actually might be true, but maybe because masks and social distancing protocols, all these procedures have been put in place. So it is voluntary. Miami-Dade County Public Schools does have a mandatory mask policy for everyone, staff, students, everybody who goes in person. Unclear right now if they will actually make it voluntary. Not clear. And we also have a few months out before the start of the 21-22 school year, which is when this ask kind of goes into effect.
Right. We got to get through this school year first, Colleen. And there are plans for in-person graduation this year.
Yes, there are. They'll take place between June 1st to June 9th. Every graduate gets two tickets, only two tickets, and those two guests will be like sitting in a pod. There's going to be coordinated ways of getting to your seats and making sure everything's socially distanced. There will be no handshakes when graduates receive their diplomas. They'll just get the diploma cover at the end of a 6-foot-long table. So very close almost to new normal. Not quite there yet, but it seems like this is maybe what the school district could do to make it safe and give these graduates, the class of 2021, who has spent their entire senior year in quarantine, just some semblance of normalcy.
Colleen Wright, education reporter for our partner at the Miami Herald. Always a pleasure, Colleen. Thanks.
Thank you.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN, 800-743-WLRN, on the telephone, 800-743-9576, or on Twitter at WLRN. Scott Travis, education reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, is with us now. Andrew Mara, also with us. Andrew is the education reporter at the Palm Beach Post. Both Broward County and Palm Beach County, both announcing back to in-class, in-person, 100% instruction in the fall of 2021, in August. Scott, how prepared are Broward County Public Schools to welcome back 100% of students come August of the next school year?
I guess we'll have to find out. I don't know. They didn't really say how prepared they actually are. They have had about 45% of students that have been attending in person already. Now, the big issue, there's a lot of schools that are pretty vacant anyways, just because of low enrollment that's happened over the years. But there are some schools like Cypress Bay High School, one of the most crowded schools in the state, about 5,000 kids when it's at its peak. That might be hard to accommodate everybody and still maintain some of the social distancing that they've done in the past. But there's also been suggestions by the CDC that perhaps you don't have to do 6 feet anymore, that maybe you can only do 3 feet if the kids are wearing masks.
And Andrew,
which we don't know if they'll be wearing yet.
Right. We'll get to the mask issue in a moment here, Scott. It is red hot, of course, in Florida, particularly when it comes to public schools. Andrew, how about Palm Beach County schools? How prepared are those schools to welcome back all students in the fall?
I think as prepared as they can be, Tom. But like Scott said, there are going to be a lot of schools that are very crowded on a normal day, and it's going to get tricky fitting all the kids into all the classrooms. And so I think there's going to need to be some, you know, they're going to have to confront the question whether they bend the rules in some places or figure out some other places to put kids. It's not going to be simple in schools that have high enrollments.
Yeah. The two big rules, of course, for students and teachers this school year who are back in the classroom, social distancing and masks or some kind of facial covering. Scott, as you point out, and Andrew as well, when you're 100% capacity at these schools, maintaining social distancing at 6 feet, maybe even 3 feet, could be just impossible, which brings up the mask question. This week, Richard Corcoran, the education commissioner, sent a letter asking school districts not to mandate masks. Has Broward County put forward what the plan is going to be regarding facial coverings or masks next school year?
They have not. What they have said is that they will follow the guidance of the CDC and the local health officials, which may be different than what Commissioner Corcoran is recommending. I think the big issue right now is that there's a long time between now and when the school year opens. Yeah. So things could be dramatically different, or maybe by that point, the CDC says it's okay for elementary school kids because they don't tend to spread it as much as the high school kids. Maybe they would be okay without having masks, or maybe they will continue to say you need to either do social distancing and no masks, or maybe do 3 feet with masks. Anything could come. We just don't know. The CDC guidance seems to change on a weekly basis. So what's going to be the rules in August? I don't know.
Yeah, we did see the CDC guidance regarding travel, for instance, change as vaccine distribution has continued to expand nationwide. Andrew, what about in Palm Beach County? Any declaration yet in terms of mask requirements for students or staff next school year?
So far, all they've basically said is that they have no plans at this point to change their policy. To Scott's point, it's likely things will evolve a lot in the next 4 months, but currently they say they're sticking with the CDC guidelines. It's not clear what authority Richard Corcoran has to force schools to stop the mask requirements, but I think there is some appetite for flexibility. First of all, a lot of teachers who were polled have said they would prefer to not have to wear a mask while they're teaching at the front of the classroom, if they've been vaccinated, so they're I wouldn't be surprised to see some flexibility there. And there's also the issue of if you're requiring all students come back to school, what do you do with families who are just dead set opposed to masks? It becomes a really tricky question.
Yeah. What about families that are dead set against going back into the classroom, have had maybe a good experience with virtual learning during this pandemic year and want to remain online for personal or health reasons? Andrew, is there going to be an online option only in Palm Beach County?
There is, but like Colleen said regarding Miami-Dade, it's a virtual school option. It's not the same as sitting on Zoom in your bedroom and seeing your teacher live. It's more of a correspondence type class. It's where, you know, you kind of work at your own pace and you do have a teacher you can talk to, but it's not live classes. So it's very different. And really, it's not ideally suited for probably most students, certainly many students. It's really not optimal. So it's going to be some tough choices for parents if they want to do that, if it's the right fit for them.
I haven't heard that phrase in a while, correspondence education. Yeah, when you used to do it through snail mail. Now it's a little bit more immediate, but nonetheless kind of on demand as opposed to, as you mentioned, in real time. But Scott, what about in Broward County? We heard a few moments ago the soundbite from Superintendent Runcie saying 100% of students back in the classroom. Will there be an online option for Broward?
Yes, but it'll be the same online option that existed pre-pandemic, which is Broward virtual. And of course, there's the Florida Virtual, which is a state-run program. Broward really would prefer that parents not do this because the funding for these virtual programs tends to be less than it is for the face-to-face students to come in. So that will still be an option that they will have, just like they had it before. And like Andrew said, this is not this is not learning where you have a teacher and a class and you all are doing the same thing you might be doing in a regular classroom. You're just doing it via video conferencing. This is one where you are given an assignment and you have to kind of work at your own pace and then turn in things, you know, by deadlines. And you're really not interacting with any other students and you're not really interacting that much with the teacher either.
Yeah, a much, much, much different educational experience than even online learning during this pandemic school year. Scott Travis, education reporter at the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Andrew Mara, education reporter at the Palm Beach Post. Fellas, thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us. Always great to hear from you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Still to come on the South Florida Roundup, we're going to move to gaming, the latest on how gambling could change in South Florida. That's next. We're back on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Like the annual Florida Derby horse race held every March at Gulfstream Park in Hallandale Beach, it's a sure bet every year the Florida legislature is going to talk about gambling. This year's no different, except lawmakers may actually do something with it this year. It's a hot topic each year because of the hundreds of billions of dollars at stake for the state, jobs, and strong opinions about how and where people are allowed to legally make a bet in the Sunshine State. Mary Ellen Kloss has followed this for a good number of years as the Capitol Bureau Chief in Tallahassee for our news partner, the Miami Herald. Mary Ellen, welcome back to the Roundup. Always nice to have you.
Sure, good to be here.
Oh my goodness, here we are again, right? Like a stopped clock, Groundhog Day, talking about gambling as the days and weeks wind down at the legislative session. Let's start with the bills that have been moving here this week in the Senate. One is a decoupling proposal. This has been talked about for a number of years, allowing racetracks and highlife frontons to have slot machines but not hold horse races and highlife matches that they now have to. What's the intent of this bill?
Well, part of it is because there's been such an increase in declining popularity of these live races as slot machines and card rooms have become more popular. So the owners of these tracks say that requiring them to continue to operate these expensive races means that they can't make money off their business anymore. And so they're trying to reduce their costs. It doesn't mean that they won't hold races. It's just they no longer will be mandated to do it by the state.
Would it allow the slot machines to physically move away from the racetracks and frontons to move to another location?
Well, that is not allowed at this point, but you can see how this might slowly lead to erosion and change in the existing statutes.
Yeah, opens the door potentially. Yeah. Two other bills moving in the Senate create a state gambling commission, kind of an oversight regulatory body. How is gaming regulated now if there's not a commission for it, which is pretty familiar in other states with statewide gaming?
Right. Well, Florida, because of the way it's evolved, has just established this patchwork quilt of regulation. Most of it is now housed under the Division of Parimutuel Wagering, which is under a larger state agency. But the law enforcement oversight is really all over the place. It's pretty dependent on local counties and cities, and that is what they're trying to correct. And so they're proposing this Gaming Control Commission, which is modeled
consolidate regulation a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah.
What's the latest on sports betting? This has been allowed under a court ruling from a few years ago and is a hot topic in Florida.
Right. So sports betting, because of the ruling, has just exploded across the country. There are now about 29 states, and the most recent one was Arizona, which announced yesterday that they have a agreement with their Native American tribes to do sports betting at their professional stadiums and at the tribe casinos. And it's something that is enormously popular and is one of those
and
things
lucrative.
Where people... Well, it's lucrative. It's kind of lucrative in the sense that it's high volume, low margins, mm-hmm. but it does produce a lot of tax revenue for states that have done that. So the question is, can Florida move that direction? And that is what's been one of the things that they've been trying to negotiate all session behind the scenes.
Negotiate with the Seminole tribe specifically, right?
Yes. And the reason they're negotiating with the tribe is that they want the tribe to start restoring the money that it had been paying the state for its exclusive operations of blackjack and its other casinos. So they want to give the tribe something so that they can start getting revenue from them back.
Yeah. To the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars a year for state revenue.
Right.
What's the latest on the efforts of the owner of the Fountain Blue Hotel in Miami Beach to move a casino permit that owner currently has in Hallandale Beach to Miami Beach?
Right. Well, that is, so Jeff Sofer, the owner of the Fountain Blue, has a casino at, you know, the Big Easy Casino in Broward. Mm-hmm. And he's been trying all session to get approval to move his permit over to Miami-Dade. They're trying to put that and negotiate that as a part of this compact, this agreement with the Seminole tribe. The tribe has indicated it doesn't oppose it. It doesn't see that Sofer's operation would be a competitor, but there is enormous resistance from locals, from Miami-Dade, from Miami Beach, as you guys have talked about before.
Yep.
So it does appear as if that has hit the skids. And while I'm hearing that the tribe is back at the table after kind of rejecting a proposal from the governor earlier in the week, it does seem I'm hearing that the Miami Beach transfer is no longer still alive, but nothing is dead quite yet.
Okay. It's not dead until the handkerchief falls in Tallahassee, so to speak. And when Mary Ellen hears something, you can bet that it's from very well-placed sources on any number of issues, and particularly the issue of gaming. Mary Ellen, always great to have you here. Do you think a compact, a deal with the tribe gets through?
Well, it was interesting because yesterday we asked Senate President Wilton Simpson about this, and this is really a top priority for him. And he said, well, we may not get it done, but we're thinking about a special session. So just the idea that they're throwing that idea out there means it's still alive enough.
Yeah, alive enough. Mary Ellen Klass is the Capitol Bureau Chief in Tallahassee with our news partner, the Miami Herald. Mary Ellen, always great to have you on the program. Thanks so much for sharing your sources, what you're hearing, and all your reporting with us here.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Finally, on the roundup this week, poetry and your postal code. It's an ode to your zip code. We're partnering again this year with the O Miami Poetry Festival, inviting you to write an ode to your zip code during April, National Poetry Month.
Hi, my name is Libetsi Chiron. I live in Miami, Florida. My zip code is 33174, and this is my zip ode.
Hold on a second. Let me interrupt you just for a moment, Libetsi. The rules are simple. Use your five-digit zip code to write a five-line poem. Each digit of your zip code determines how many words per line. Okay, Libetsi in Miami, take it away.
This is my zip ode. I want croquetas from Jesse's Bakery, but I'm only wearing my bata de casa and feel so lazy.
My name is Chris. I live in Pompano Beach, Florida. My zip code is 33062. Our lighthouse keeps boats from sinking. What will boats do when our lighthouse sinks?
This is my zip ode. Tall banyans loom, taking shape of monsters in the dark. What if they talked? My name's Mary Beth. I live in Coral Gables, Florida, and my zip code is 33134.
You can write your own zip ode using our handy-dandy online tool. You'll find it at wlrn.org/zipodes. wlrn.org/zipodes. The deadline is coming up, so write that zip ode now. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Andrea Perdomo. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The WLRN director of radio programming is Jason Zabka. The director of radio operations and the program's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting WLRN. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.